Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode of the podcast is author and journalist Sean Egan. His new book, Decade of Descent, How 1960s Bob Dylan Changed the World, is out May 20th via Jawbone Press. It arrives just before Dylan's 84th birthday and examines, as you can figure out by the title, that first and most important decade, really, in Dylan's career. Egan has written extensively about music of the past, including works on The Who, The Jam, Small Faces, and Rod Stewart. He's also written about television and film, including works on the Walter Hill classic The Warriors, the Planet of the Apes universe, and the beloved UK soap opera Coronation Street. I spoke with Sean Egan about Decade of Descent and Bob Dylan in his many guises for this episode of Into Music, which is coming up now. Where did this begin for you? What was kind of the genesis of it?
Well, I've been a Dylan fan for decades now. I did an article about 15 years ago on Highway 61 Revisited, and I interviewed a lot of the musicians who worked on the album, and Daniel Kramer, who did the cover photograph. Not Bob Dylan, unfortunately. It's very difficult to get an interview with Bob, obviously. But I had so much interview material, and even though the article was quite long, I just, as with all magazine features, you just don't get to use the vast majority of the interview material that you've accumulated. So that was always at the back of my mind, that this material might make the basis for a good book one day. And this year, of course, is the 60th anniversary of Dylan going electric, so that seemed an ideal point at which to use this material.
Yeah. So that first decade is pretty interesting for a number of reasons, one of which, of course, is that this is, in terms of popular music, it's still kind of uncharted territory, at least when you look at people like Dylan or the Beatles or things like that. That's one. And then somebody like Dylan, who kind of remakes themselves several times in a kind of short period of time.
Yeah, and Dylan, he wasn't he didn't sell the most records out of his contemporaries, but he was easily the most important figure in 60s music. He, the Stones and the Beatles sold, and even Dave Clark Five sold a lot more records than he did. But they looked up to him because he was the groundbreaker, the trendsetter. He's the one who married folk to rock and proved that rock music didn't just have to be about Moon in June type subjects or banal subjects, that it could actually give you a lot more as a listener than had ever been imagined, because his lyrics were poetry and they were intellectual, and yet they now had the visceral excitement of a rock beat behind them.
And of course they are all of those things, and yet you have Dylan himself, who kind of, I think in some ways, insists that he's not an intellectual.
Yeah, the thing about Bob Dylan, and you'll find this if you research him, as you have to do if you're writing about him, is that for every quote that you can find about Bob Dylan on one subject, you can find another quote from him on the subject that completely contradicts the other quote. He's a very convoluted person. You know, sometimes, just to give you an example, the Self-Portrait album, which most people consider to be a deliberately bad album that he made in order to get rid of the people who were insisting that he was their spokesman or their hero and what have you. He's admitted it was a bad album, deliberately bad album in some quotes, but in other quotes, which seemed just as sincere, he said it was a great album and people didn't listen to it properly, and that's why they don't consider it to be very good. So you have to sort of wade through that and come to a conclusion on the balance of probabilities about what his real motivations and his real thoughts are. I think he is an intellectual in the sense that he thinks about things. He's not somebody who thinks that ignorance is a good thing. So to take with a grain of salt stuff that how he doesn't consider himself to be an intellectual.
This is something that I've found fascinating, because I've tried to sort of explain to a younger colleague, like the Don't Look Back. This colleague has never seen it, and I'm trying to explain, and he's like, "Is this guy? Is he just like trolling everybody?"
Yeah, there's a certain mischievousness behind Dylan. He liked toying with people.
Yeah. So as the decade kind of goes along, you know, you get these albums and these songs that just seem to come one after the other in many ways. And you know, something like My Back Pages and so forth and so on. When you're looking back at this, when you're writing the book, I imagine that you're going back and listening to some of these again. Are there, even after all these years, things that you find within these songs as you listen back to them?
Well, we all change as we get older, and so we hear stuff and understand stuff that we didn't appreciate at the time. I remember the first time I listened to Blood on the Tracks, I was a teenager. Now, that's a divorce album, so it didn't strike me when I was listening to it, knowing absolutely nothing about life, or at least that part of life, it didn't strike me that it was a great record. And then a few years later, it suddenly clicked, and I could understand it. So, yeah, we all, as we get older, we all begin to appreciate nuances and aspects of stuff that we didn't understand when we were younger. I don't really feel that way about something like Highway 61 Revisited, which is his masterpiece, as far as most people are concerned. Came out in 1965, his second album of the year, in fact. I think that's a pretty immediate album, and you understand its power pretty immediately. You know, no matter what age you are. I think it depends on the record, really.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Highway 61 Revisited, because it does have that visceral element to it still after all this time. It wasn't like he was saving this up for his entire life, so I think that demonstrates of just how good he was, that he could make these kind of statements, and as you said, you know, make that the second album within one calendar year.
Yeah, and of course he released three albums within about 14 months, because Blonde on Blonde was just around the corner, and that's a double album. But it is absolutely incredible that he was able to not only be so prolific, but to maintain the quality as he released these albums. And not just that, but they were incredibly groundbreaking albums. There'd literally never been music heard like this before. Highway 61 is really the masterpiece out of the three of them. The other one is Bringing It All Back Home, which came out earlier in 65. The reason for that is it's just got everything. It starts with Like a Rolling Stone, which is an incredible, quite startling, venomous 6-minute song, which actually became the most unlikely hit single. And it ends with Desolation Row, which is a 12-minute tour de force in which he seems to explore every aspect of human existence and does it in beautifully poetic song words. So you've got those two bookends. That's how it begins. That's how it ends. And that would be enough, really, those two songs to make anybody's reputation. But in between those two songs, he's got stunning songs like Ballad of a Thin Man and Queen Jane Approximately and Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues. I mean, it's just almost laughable how good that album is.
Ballad of a Thin Man is one that definitely sticks with me. It's sort of, I think, if I were to say, like, you know, here in 2025, you know, like, what's one of your favorite Dylan tunes? That one rises to the top very quickly for me. And I'm not entirely sure exactly what it is. It does have this kind of quality where I'm like, I love this, but I don't fully understand it necessarily.
Well, it's a very Stygian, murky, menacing song. I mean, it's beautifully recorded. It's clear, crystal clear, and Dylan's voice sounds like it's directly in front of your face in that particular song. But it is very eerie, and it's quite a controversial topic in a way, because if you listen to the lyric, a lot of people have interpreted it as a song about a straight man. Who blunders into a gay orgy. If you know, lines like, the sword swallower comes up to you and then he kneels. Well, that seems pretty straightforward when you think about it. And there are quite a few songs in Dylan's canon where he does seem to be making a sort of veiled reference to a sex life that is not a conventional one, certainly not for the times. In fact, there's one Dylan scholar called Craig McGregor, who said that there seems to be a conspiracy of silence amongst Dylan's fans about this particular topic.
And Desolation Row, which has got those, of course, that wonderful, wonderful and terrible, you know, the postcards, selling postcards of the hangings. And there are just so many lines in there that are, you know, I think people would be envious or hopeful that they could write something that good one day. And there are just so many of them in there.
I think the most interesting verse in Desolation Row is about the one about Cinderella, who's sweeping up. Romeo comes into the bar where she's working, smashes the place up, and after all the ambulance has gone, Cinderella is left sweeping up. That sounds pretty much like the most feminist thing that Dylan has ever written. And of course there's several other verses almost as good. There are layers and depths to Dylan's worldview that you might not suspect when you first come across him.
And then, of course, you know, you mentioned earlier Blonde on Blonde, which is this kind of sprawling record and has still quite a bit of magic in it. A lot of really great songs and so forth, but this is also him going to Nashville. Tell me a little bit more about that record.
Well, people just didn't do that in those days. Pop and rock artists didn't go to Nashville because this was just at the point where pop music and rock music was beginning to be perceived as the soundtrack to a new social order, the libertarian 60s, the meeting place for the young and their values. And, of course, country music in those days was considered to be represent the values that were completely opposite to that, the good old boys, if you like, the backward looking, the conservative, okay, that's a simplistic way of looking at things, but that was the way people felt at the time. Now Dylan didn't care about that. He'd just been told that if he went to Nashville, he could have the best studio musicians in the land, because he'd tried recording a few tracks in New York for Blonde on Blonde with the band, the Hawks, and they just weren't working out. And he got tired of this, decamped to Nashville, and instantly gelled with the musicians, and they gelled with him. And even though they'd never heard songs like this before with lyrics like this and time signatures like this and lengths like this, because he was still doing 12-minute songs like Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands and 7-minute songs like Visions of Johanna. But it all worked, and he'd come in and they'd do it in a minimal number of takes. Sometimes he'd be writing lyrics while they were playing cards, and this was, you know, the amount of money this was costing him, but he didn't care. He wanted to perfect his lyrics. And it's a very personal album. It's not like Highway 61, where you have this state of the nation address, the songs like Desolation Row. Instead, all the songs are about himself, but of course done in this beautifully poetic manner. Visions of Johanna is just an absolutely exquisite, transcendent recording. And there's several other songs on there like that. And also, some, interestingly enough, some very poppy songs like I Want You and Just Like a Woman, you know, which are verse-chorus, middle-eight, very pretty on the surface. But, of course, this is a unique lyricist. And if you listen to the lyrics, there's something far, far deeper going on than just your average pop song.
Of course, this relationship with the Hawks is quite interesting, because this is a time where he kind of takes them on this tour where they're being booed and so forth and so on, and they kind of hang with him, of course, except for Levon Helm. What do you think he gets out of that relationship with Robbie Robertson and company?
Well, Robbie Robertson was a friend and a sounding board, I think. I mean, he never really collaborated in terms of songwriting. The relationship with the band beyond Robertson is quite peculiar, because their names are synonymous to an extent because of that incredible tour of 65, 66, where they were booed to the rafters by the folk fans who felt he was selling out by moving over to rock music. And also, of course, the tour 74 that they did almost a decade later. But they only ever recorded one album together, which was Planet Waves in 74. Although they went on this incredible journey together around the world, revolutionizing music by bringing the intellectualism of folk to the excitement of rock, they never quite gelled in the studio. Which is why he had to go to, or felt he had to go to Nashville to record Blonde on Blonde. Planet Waves is quite a nice album, but despite the fact that their names are synonymous, it's quite an ambivalent relationship in a way.
Yeah, and I've always found it interesting too that I don't think that they really become the band as we know them for quite some time. I feel like they've been playing together before we get that sound that we hear on those, you know, wonderful early recordings from them. So they weren't fully cooked, I guess, when they were with Dylan in some ways.
Yeah, and he nurtured them into from the Hawks, which is what they were, to the band, and they eventually had their own very successful career. Of course, I forgot to mention just now that although they officially released one album together, they did record the Basement Tapes together, which is the album that he made, a sort of album that they made after Blonde on Blonde. He'd had a motorcycle accident. He used it to cry off from all commitments, because he was just driving himself to the brink of a physical and mental collapse. So his manager said, well, okay, if you're not going to record anything and you're not going to tour, can you at least record some songs so I can sell them to other artists to cover you? Because, of course, he was being covered more than any other songwriter in the entire world at the time, especially in 1965, when just about everybody and his dog recorded a Dylan song. And so he recorded these songs, which later became known as the Basement Tapes. The band happened to be in Woodstock, where he lived, because they were busily signing to Albert Grossman, his manager, so that he could give them a career. So he used them as a backing band on those tracks, and they actually seemed to work, even though They were recorded in very primitive conditions, which give those songs a very musty, oldie-worldy sound. And so although they only released officially that one album together, they recorded the basement tapes, they circulated amongst the rock aristocracy and had a very significant effect upon them because they loved their back-to-basics sound. And they sort of turned their backs on psychedelia after that and copied Dylan's, what they considered to be Dylan's new sound. He didn't consider it to be his new sound. It was just the way he recorded the songs. And eventually they did get an official release, or some of them, in 1975 on a double album. And much, much later, decades later, they were all of those songs were released on CD. So the world did eventually get to hear them.
He does make these records, John Wesley Harding, which has this reputation. I know a lot of people who do love it. I've always found it a little bit of a difficult record to get into. And there, too, I'm not always sure why. It's one of those things that just, to me as a listener, it doesn't give itself up quite as easily as some of the others.
Well, it's obviously, by this point in his career, he was draping all of his observations in metaphor and simile. But it's clearly a concept album about one man's journey from torments into domestic bliss. And that one man can only be Bob Dylan, even though he couches his observations in terms of invented characters, joker men and thieves and vagabonds and things like that. I mean, John Wesley Harding, the title character, that seemed to be somebody perceived as a hero who knows he doesn't really deserve his hero status. If you listen to the lyrics, they're very ambivalent in that song. That's clearly Dylan talking about himself. And then the tracks afterwards, like As I Went Out One Morning, which is a very eerie song, they're clearly about a man who is tempted by the blandishments of fame and such like, and is not proud of his behaviour and has come to realise that his behaviour was wrong. And the final two tracks are just love songs. They're a man who has shrugged off all his previous torment and embraced marriage, which is, of course, what Dylan had done himself in his private life round about that time.
and, of course, the famous self-portrait album and Marcus's review of What Is This Shit? is this the first time, though, that we really kind of see, or maybe some people see Dylan as... he's capable of making something that we perceive as not being genius.
Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of that when Nashville Skyline came out in 69. That was the follow-up to John Wesley Harding. Now, that was actually a polished record, and it had a couple of classics on it, one of which was Lay Lady Lay. But it was a very slight record. It was under half an hour in length, and several of the songs were quite banal. You know, he dispensed with all the poetry and the simile, and he was suddenly writing, well, Moon in June songs, which he had seemed to be the antidote to when he'd first come along. He'd proven that popular music could be more than Moon in June songs. Again, he's a very convoluted, layered, playful character, so maybe he was taking the piss, as we say in this country. But it just seemed a very odd album for him to make, especially considering it was a country album. Although Blonde on Blonde had been recorded in Nashville, there was absolutely no country and western strains to it. But this was an out-and-out country record, and it wasn't like the kind of... experiments with country rock of the submarine band, International Submarine Band. It was just straightforward, unabashed country. So some people reviewing that record were saying, is he putting us on, or is he sincere? It just didn't seem conceivable that somebody as intellectual and complicated and intelligent as Dylan would embrace the cliches of country orthodoxy. But as I say, it did contain a couple of classic songs, so the reviews weren't terrible. But then the next album, Self-Portrait, 1970, double album, mostly cover songs, swamped in syrupy string arrangements. And people were thinking, this is the poet laureate of rock and roll. Why would we want to listen to him singing songs by other people in corny arrangements? But of course, there was a story behind it, because he just wanted people to leave him alone. He was plagued by nutcases where he lived in Woodstock, upstate New York. And you know, things like the Woodstock Festival, that only was intended to take place in Woodstock, precisely to tempt him out of what was considered to be his semi-retirement. He just felt that, like he was being endlessly pestered by people who he had nothing in common with anymore.
And of course, he is, just as we all are, he is getting chronologically older and becoming more of the man probably that he would be later in life.
Yeah, he's gone through several personality changes now. I mean, the embracing domestic bliss in the early 70s or late 60s, early 70s, that was one thing. Then he went through divorce, of course, which a lot of people of his age group and his generation went through. Terribly traumatic event, but it bequeathed a wonderful album, Blood on the Tracks, which indeed was his artistic renaissance. And not many people have observed that was actually the first album that proved that people of his cohort could still be viable, because the Stones and the solo Beatles and everybody else in the mid-70s had for several years been treading water and making mediocre albums. And he was the first of that generation to actually put out a classic album that was as good as anything he'd done in the 60s. And after that, of course, we have the Born Again trilogy of the late 70s, early 80s, which would just seemed an unbelievable event at the time. The idea that Dylan could embrace the orthodoxies of religion after having seemed to set his face against that throughout his entire career and life previously. And he's gone through various permutations of personality and style ever since. So it's difficult sometimes to know whether he still has the same values that he had, for instance, when he was writing his protest songs in 63 and 64. But like all human beings, he's complicated.
With Blood on the Tracks, he writes Simple Twist of Fate, and that to me has such a wonderful narrative to it. And it is that kind of like, I think it's, you know, superior to a lot of what he wrote in the 60s. And coupled with Tangled Up in Blue, those are real, you know, touchstones on that record. And it's sort of like, oh, yes, he's still got it. And he's got it a little bit more maybe than what he did before because of those factors, I think, that we were talking about, the maturity and so forth.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Blood on the Tracks, he would never have been able to write in the 60s because he didn't understand, as we all don't, relationships in his 20s. He didn't understand the nuances of them the way that he would after having been in a very long-term relationship by the by his 30s. So that was one of the reasons that it was such a great comeback, because for the first time he was providing us something that he could never have provided us before. But doing it, of course, with the same wonderful gift for poetic lyrics. And by the way, a great gift for writing melody. People don't remark on this that much, but when he moved over to, when he went electric in 65, something he did at the same time was that for the first time, at least on record, he began writing his own tunes. because previously he just used old folk melodies and added his lyrics. That's what folk music is. It's using old tunes that are out of copyright and, in fact, that were written before the very term copyright even existed. But Highway 61 Revisited is the first album that he made where you can't point to the songs and say, I know where he got that melody from. And there was no reason to believe that he could necessarily write very good melodies, because a lot of people can't. They might be able to write good lyrics, but not necessarily great melodies. But as it transpired, he was a very good tunesmith, and that, to me, that reached its peak. Well, Ballad of a Thin Man is a great tune, and I think it's the first Dylan song with a middle eight, with a bridge. And then that reaches its peak for me on Blood on the Tracks with You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go, which is one of the most beautiful melodies ever written.
There is a lot of Dylan scholarship out there and books, and some of them take on wild theories and so forth. And here Dylan is now in his 80s and so forth. It seems like there's, it's kind of unstoppable in terms of like thinking about him, contemplating him and his career and writing about him. Do you think that this is something that's going to continue, you know, say into the next century, that we'll still have this kind of Dylan obsession?
It never seems to end. I remember there was a book published, I think it was in the 90s, and the title was Oh No, Not Another Bob Dylan Book, which was a reference to the fact that more has been written about him than any other musician or performer in post Elvis popular music, what we used to call rock music. He just seems to inspire endless books, partly of course because his lyrics, some of them are so elusive, so enigmatic that it gives rise to endless interpretation. It does seem to be something that's going to continue at least for the foreseeable future.
I'm Jed Bodwin, and you've been listening to a conversation with author and journalist Sean Egan on this episode of Into Music. His new book, Decade of Descent, How 1960s Bob Dylan Changed the World, is out May 20th wherever books are sold via Jawbone Press. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson. You can send us questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. And you can also find out more about all programming on this station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.